right. Paul's developing, and we're cutting in the middle of an argument here. And the argument is an answer to the question that the Corinthians ask. And the question is, can I go into the temple? We've already talked about that. We've reviewed it. We get that. And at one level, our response to that, and we've already looked at it, is this is a trite thing. This is about where you're going to eat dinner. And so, one, why does God care about where I'm going to eat? All right, that has to be a question that's formed within the mind. And then two, why do the Corinthians care? And I trust that we, in some ways, have answered those questions. The Corinthians care because this is a major issue within their culture. And God cares, well, because God cares about everything that we do. Which is something that we're going to have to reckon with even as we continue. The oft-repeated verses, whether therefore you eat or drink or whatsoever you do, do all to the glory of God. Sometimes we take that verse out of the context in which it's in, which is 1 Corinthians 10:31, and where what is God talking about in 1 Corinthians 10? Eating and drinking. So the very triteness, the mundaneness of eating and drinking, God has an opinion about as far as your life is concerned. So if he cares about what you eat and drink, right, the basics of life, of sustenance, then he obviously cares about everything else too. So, and that's really the point that he's making with the Corinthians. God has a say in everything that you do as a believer, including the issues which he seemingly hasn't said anything directly about. See, and this is where the tension comes in. Sometimes we say, well, God has a say in our life in areas that he's spoken to. But in areas that he hasn't directly spoken to, well, then I get to say. And God's response to that in 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10 is no, 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 no. Just because I haven't given specific commands on a particular area doesn't mean I don't have a say. But what I'm going to say is going to be in more principle form, and I'm going to give you the responsibility and the opportunity to respond with yes, no, or maybe, depending upon the context that you find yourself in. So God has a say in everything. These principles are for those areas in which there is no direct scriptural instruction. We've looked at two. Right? Paul's making his argument. He says, but some, not having this knowledge, are impacted by their weak conscience. Right? In the weak conscience that's being spoken of there is the recognition that when they see an idol, they still imagine that there's a God behind that. Now, Paul's already said that's not true. But their conscience impacts them in such a way that it forms the authority within their life, and their conscience says, stop. They think the speed limit is 25. And because they think the speed limit is 25, if they press the gas pedal beyond that, they are rejecting the authority within their life. And until that officer comes and says, no, the speed limit is 40, they're bound by their conscience. Now, in time, God, through his word, may enlarge their understanding from a scriptural perspective. They're bound by their conscience in that area. Second principle is simply this. We all have a responsibility toward one another to flesh out a life of a godly example. Doesn't mean that your conscience is my guide. But it does mean that I am responsible to make sure that I don't entrap your conscience in your context as far as life is concerned. You say, G movies? I'm not going to put a PG movie in front of you. You say, I'm not comfortable listening to this kind of music. I don't say, it's my car, get out and walk. Okay, I don't do that. I don't put my arm around someone and lead them into a situation where their conscience is going to be offended. And I'm using that not in the sense of emotion, but in the sense of real spiritual entrapment. Right. Two principles that I'm always keeping in mind anytime I make decisions. What's going on inside of me? Conscience. What's my responsibility to the people that are outside of me? I'll go back to my initial illustration. When I talked about would I go to the bar at Ohio State University for lunch, some of you immediately stopped and you went, who cares if someone from your church sees you? You're going there for the sake of the gospel. It doesn't matter what anyone else thinks. It does, though. Now, I'm not bound by them, but I do have to be aware of it. And then I have to work through the way that that's going to get fleshed out as far as life decisions are concerned. Right? Those are two principles that we've looked at. We're going to keep walking. We have a few more to go. Number three, simply this, excess. Will it slow me down in the race? We've already looked at this particular passage. Paul has argued all through chapter 9 about his personal illustrations. He has the right to ask for pay. He has the right to carry, to have a wife. He has all of these rights, and he's responded by saying, I don't practice these rights because I am running a race, and my focus is to lay aside my personal liberties. We're going to come back to this in a moment. He ends the whole concept, again, really in verse 20, 25, 26, 27, about an athlete who's exercising self-control in all things, about someone who is running, not aimlessly, someone who's boxing, but not just beating the air, but disciplining their body, beating their body, bringing it under control, because they don't want to be a dachshund. They don't want to be a disqualified. And in essence, what Paul is saying is he's the principle is that of excess. I'm not going to add things into my life that will merely slow me down in the race, whether they're right or wrong. Author of Hebrews says something similar in Hebrews chapter 12. He says that he lays aside every sin and weight which doth so easily beset him. So there are certain things, laying aside sin in our life, there's a clarity to that. But there's more than just the sin. Sometimes we can make individual choices that do nothing but weight us down as it relates to our primary responsibility of being glorifiers of God and gospel speakers. So, there are some things that could I do? Yes, I could do. But the question isn't, could I do it? The question is, should I do it? All right, and Paul's going to build on this in just a moment. So not every liberty that I can do, I should do. Because some things are going to do nothing but just slow me down. All right. Now, Paul's really going to go full force on this and lay out one concept after another. And to a certain extent, some of these are actually repetitious. Excuse, will it be a covering for my sin? I think the concept is bound within the language that Paul's even talking about, where he gives the instructions to the Corinthians that they cannot go to the temple. And he simply says in verse 20 and 21, I'll pick it up in verse 21, you cannot eat of the cup or drink of the cup of the Lord and of the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and of the table of demons. Shall we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he? There's an implication within the passage and really within Paul's flow of argumentation here is that one of the things that the Corinthians were doing was simply saying this. Hey, I want to go into the temple. I enjoy that. And I can rationalize it away. I can go on Saturday night into the temple and enjoy my celebration because it feeds my flesh. And then on Sunday I can go and I can have the Lord's table and I can do both and God's going to be okay with it. And Paul's response to that is, no, no, no. God is a jealous God and you cannot make excuses merely to cover your desires at all. There are some things, there are multiple things that are what I'll define as gray areas in life that quite honestly, we just enjoy doing them. If you were to ask why the motivation, what's driving you toward that, your response to that is, I just like it. I just like it. And because you personally like it, you begin to justify your actions and say, I can manage this, what I know to be unhealthy for my spiritual life, and I can manage God, and I can bring them both together and coalesce them in a way that God's going to be okay with. And Paul's response to that, don't make an excuse. If you find yourself, quite honestly, mentally struggling with decisions in gray areas, going, can I, should I, back and forth, and you find yourself starting to justify your actions for the sake of the flesh, that's when you know you've probably crossed the line. I used to have a pastor who said this. He said, anything that you want to do, turn around and go 180 degrees in the opposite direction. And when I first heard that, I went, what is he talking about? I mean, I'm not that bad of a person. Everything I want to do, it's not like I have to turn around and go just the opposite way. But the longer I've lived, the more I recognize that there's actually some truth to that. The natural inclinations of my depraved heart are always selfish, always driven for personal pleasure. So I check my desires. I make sure that I'm not just making an excuse for my own actions. So it's the principle of excuse that Paul's drawing on. All right, next two comes side by side within the context of the same verse. It's the principle of expedience. Will it be to my spiritual advantage? Go with me down to chapter 10, verse 23. Now, this is the section of application, so we're going to see multiple principles here. All things are lawful for me. Again, that's what the Corinthians are saying. All things are lawful. His response, but, okay, here's our cautious conjunction. Slow down. But not all things are helpful. Not all things are expedient. Not all things are beneficial. So I've got that principle, and then there's the next verse, and I'll just tie these two together. It's the principle of edification, where he continues, all things are lawful, but not all things build up. So I'm asking a series of questions here. Are my choices going to be spiritually helpful for me, and are my choices going to spiritually build me up? Now, we need to be careful that we don't go to extremes here real quick. Let me ask just a simple question. We're in the state of Ohio. Ohio State football is huge here. And so I'll ask the question. Is it spiritually profitable to watch an Ohio State football game? Right away, a couple of girls are like, nope. Of course not. The cooking show? Yes. Honestly, is it spiritually profitable to sit down and to spend 3.5 hours and watch an Ohio State football game? Answer? I'm going to suggest, sure it can be. Does God have any problem with our relaxation? Does he actually encourage it? Does he actually encourage time that of personal enjoyment? Is there anything wrong with sitting down and watching 3.5 hours of Ohio State beat Michigan? No, see, when I add that element, you all go, now that's spiritually edifying. It's like good beating evil, and, you know, it's like it's metaphorical for the great apocalypse. I can sit down and I can watch a football game. I can sit down and watch a soccer game, and I can do it for the glory of God. And I can do it from a perspective of spiritual rest without any hesitation at all. I can watch a game and I can be thankful for the opportunity for fellowship. I can be thankful for the opportunity of having loyalties. I can be thankful for the whole concept of competition. And I can be thankful that for a while I can just allow everything else to be set aside and I can pull aside and I can rest. So I can do that for the glory of God. I can do it with the spirit of edification and I can do it with the spirit of expedience. The next question is this. Can I watch 12 hours of continuous football on Saturday? And can that be spiritually edifying? Now it's everything in moderation. All right. See, personal, here, I could, I'm speaking personally, I could sit down and I could easily watch 12 hours of football on Saturday, and then I could carry it over to around 12 hours on Sunday, and then I'm thankful for both Monday night football and Thursday night. Personally, I could do that without a problem. I love football. And I don't care who's playing. I could sit there and I could choose a team to cheer for and I could watch it. But now to my question, is that going to be spiritually edifying for me? The answer there is no. So for me, I have to monitor. I have to control. I have to beat my body as to the amount of sports that I watch. I could watch sports a lot. It's the natural disposition of my heart. Okay? I have to stop and I have to say, I can do this for the glory of God. But I have to draw a line. I have to know where that line is. And if I forget where that line is, then the Holy Spirit that God's placed within my life, called my wife, tells me that I'm crossing the line. Are you going to watch another game? To which I say, submit, woman. No, I don't. I don't. It's a healthy reminder for me. Whoa, there's a line here. And that if I'm choosing to do something that is morally neutral, which is watching a football game, I can either do it positively for the glory of God within limits, or I can cross a line and I can do it selfishly, and God gets no glory in it, and I'm taking advantage of a liberty for my own selfish pleasures. So, when we talk about the spiritual, the principles of edification and the principles of expedience, we're not saying that we can't do anything of personal enjoyment. We're simply saying we have to think through what we're doing and make sure that it fits within the broader context of what is helpful for my spiritual growth. Right? Limitations. Understanding myself, understanding my flesh, but also understanding the privileges and the joy that God gives me in the process. So, those principles, again, kept in balance. And indeed, moderation is an important part of it. Exaltation, we've already read the verse. We're going to come back to this in a moment. 1 Corinthians 10:31, whether therefore we eat or drink or whatsoever we do, do all to the glory of God. So every decision that I make, I stop and I say, am I adequately and appropriately reflecting God's glory, God's attributes, God's image in the choices that I'm making? Are my clothing choices a reflection of who my God is? My musical choices a reflection of who my God is? Are my eating choices a reflection of who my God is? Are my recreational choices a reflection of who my God is? Are all the areas that I would define as gray areas, okay, areas in which God has given no direct scriptural instruction, I still have the responsibility of reflecting who my God is. Right? He has a right and a say in these areas. And again, we'll apply this in just a moment. Next principle is that of evangelism. Will it lead others to Christ? Will it lead others to Christ? I want you to follow Paul's conclusion here. Pick it up in verse 31 of chapter 10. We've read this. So whether you eat or drink or whatsoever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no offense to the Jews or to the Greeks or to the church of God. All right, so what Paul's saying there is don't inappropriately, and he really develops this in chapter 9, which we didn't look at completely. But what Paul's saying is that when he's with the Jews, he doesn't act in a way that is going to be culturally offensive to them. When he's with Gentiles, he doesn't act in a way that is going to be culturally offensive to them. And even when he's with the church, he doesn't act in a way that's going to be culturally offensive to them. He has sensitivities both to believers and unbelievers. And the reason that he has those sensitivities, he develops simply by saying this: just as I try to please everyone in everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, why? But that of many they may be saved. Go back with me to chapter 9. What's motivating all of this? Verse 23, I do it all for the sake of the gospel that I may share with them in its blessings. Paul was absolutely dominated by the thought that every decision that he made either contributed to his opportunity for evangelism or distracted from it. So he never freely, and he says it very clearly, I don't look to my own advantage here. I don't look to my own preferences. I don't look to what I want to do. I'm constantly thinking about what is going to glorify God and what is going to provide an opportunity for me to evangelize others. Those are the dominating influences within his life that dictate where he eats and what he drinks. All right, it's the principle of exaltation. The principle of evangelism that are there. One more principle, and this is the section where our New Testament, and again, we know that the verse are laid out by man as far as verse numbers. If you go to chapter 11, verse 1, I think chapter 11, verse 1 is actually the completion of Paul's argument here. I think verse 2 begins with the word now, which suggests he's changing topics. So, in chapter 11, verse 1, he simply says this: be imitators of me as I am of Christ. And this principle is simply this. It's the principle of emulation. Will my choices be like Christ? Is this a reflection of who Christ is? Over in the the boxes as you were playing soccer, someone shouted out, you know, what would Jesus do? Remember the bracelets, WWJD? I don't know if any of you still have those. When those came out, some of you know, people were debating, are those good or are those bad? Let me just say this. If wearing a bracelet that says WWJD on it causes someone to stop and to think about the choices that they're making in light of who Christ is, to me, I'm good with that. I'm good with that. Because I think that's actually what Paul's dealing with here. Paul's just saying, hey, you be followers of me, even as I am of Christ. So every decision that I make is going to have to be done in the context of Christ. And I'm going to make a strong statement here. I don't have to say, what would Christ do in this situation? Because all I have to do is go back to the Gospels and I can say, what did Christ do? I know what Christ did. Now, what he might not have been in the exact situation you are in. But I have four Gospels that give me a lot of situations that Christ was in. Matter of fact, we just sang about the sufficiency of the Word. So everything that I need to know about Christ is located within those four Gospels. So I don't have to say, what would Christ do? I can simply say, what did Christ do? And I can reflect back upon the Gospels and see how Christ it lived out the glory of God within his life. Okay? So, principle number 9 is that of emulation. What would Christ do? Now, I'm going to go to one other passage. I think you're going to see some similarities here, and we're going to bring together our 10th principle. Go back with me to chapter 6. Here, Paul, he's addressing, this is not necessarily a neutral issue. Matter of fact, it's not a neutral issue. He's talking about immorality within the church. But you'll see similar language in verse 12 of chapter 6 where he says this, all things are lawful for me. Again, Corinthians are saying this, but not all things are helpful. Exact same terminology. Next phrase, all things are lawful for me, but I will not be enslaved by anything. Last principle is simply this, it's the principle of enslavement. And the question is, will I be brought into bondage? Will I be brought into bondage? Is this choice something that is going to capture my heart and does it have the potential to be something that is addictive as far as my nature is concerned? I worked in Christian colleges for many years and at an administrative level. One of the things I did was I actually served as the dean of students, but I moved my office from the administration building into the men's dorm. And they were really excited to have the dean living with them. But I did that for a couple reasons. One is that the spiritual temperature on campus of any Christian college is always established by what happens in the men's dorm. Always. And gals, you can be as wonderful and as spiritual as you want to be, but the spiritual temperature of the campuses will always be defined by what happens, not outside in the classrooms, but what happens in the men's dorm. And I thought, if I'm going to have responsibility for the spiritual temperature on campus, I want to stick my finger right where the heat is. And I want to know what it's like. So I actually moved into the men's dorm and just hung out with them. It was great. Because the walls speak. And so you know everything that's going on all the time. When one guy got a tattoo. And, you know, I heard about it. I mean, boom, just like that. So I called him in my office, and we're chit-chatting. I said, so what did you do this weekend? And he tells me what he did, and he's kind of, and finally he just looks at me, and he says, you heard. I said, heard what? And he went, all right, you heard, didn't you? I said, what? He said, you heard I got a tattoo. I went, yeah, I did. I said, show it to me. And so he got a tattoo, and it was on his back here. And it was like three little triangles coming together, and he got it on his back. And I looked at him and I said, and I called him by name. I said, why'd you get that tattoo? You know, that's kind of a unique one. And he looked at me and he was like, well, when I saw the three-eyed triangles, I thought of the Trinity. I went, oh, okay. I said, so you know, it's kind of like God's got your back. And he was like, yeah. And he said, you know, I thought when I go out and I play basketball on the street, you know, when we did shirts and skins, I'd take my shirt off and people would ask the same thing you did. And they'd say, so why did you get that tattoo? And I said, well, it's the Trinity. And then I'd use it as an opportunity to share the gospel. And I looked at him and I said, really? And he went, no, not really. He said, but I think I'll use that. I'm good with that. You can use that. I said, why did you get the tattoo? And he looked at me and he said, "Because that was cool." You know what? You can think through from a scriptural perspective the issue of tattoos. My issue with that individual, and we had a great conversation, my issue wasn't necessarily him getting the tattoo. My issue was the reason why he got it. He said, "I got it so that I could be like others." Okay. Is that the right kind of motivation? Is that the principle that you're going to utilize through the rest of your life and all life's choices? Or is there something that's going to be more permanent and higher that is going to motivate you in your choices? That was the teaching moment. Right? That's what I wanted him to think about. And ink on the back, he can live with that the rest of his life. He can work through that. But why you live, that's important. The other issues that were probably the most common issues that were being discussed in the dorm, one was alcohol. We've already talked a little bit about that. And the second one was gambling. All the guys wanted to play poker all the time. It's a card game. Morally neutral. Okay? Cards are not possessed. Pieces of paper, stamps on them. Okay? Playing cards, whether you're playing Skippo, whether you're playing Uno, whether you're playing poker, cards are cards. Okay? But the question is this: what's motivating you in that? And does it have the potential to enslave you? Right. Slight side issue, but I'll go ahead and throw it out. Do you know how many hours a week the average male college freshman spends playing video games? This is recorded. Right? So this is real numbers here. The average college freshman male spends 28 and a half hours a week playing video games. 28 and a half hours. Now, again, usually when I say that, the gals are just like, "No way." Gals, I'd simply say this. If you date, that's one of the first questions you should ask a guy. Okay? That way you know whether you're dating a man or a boy. Okay? So it's kind of like a dividing line right there. You know what? There's some video games that from my perspective, they don't pass through the filter of that which is biblically acceptable. All right, so there's some video games that don't even pass through the filter, the very first question of direct command. There's other video games that are acceptable. But is it going to enslave me? That's the question. And if it's going to enslave me, then Paul says, just say no. Don't allow yourself to be enslaved by something that is going to detract from your capacity to reflect the image of God and to evangelize others. Okay, so the question is, "Okay, Paul, can we go to the temple and eat the meat?" And my guess is what they were looking for was a kind of a yes or no answer. Instead, they got 73 verses. And Paul lays it out and he says, "I know that you have lots of knowledge, but really love should trump knowledge. Because love should trump knowledge, you have to start thinking about your own conscience to begin with. And second, you need to be thinking about entrapping others in the process. I know that you have rights, but you need to be thinking about the gospel because the gospel actually trumps your personal rights. And because of that, I beat my own self for the sake of the gospel." Don't be making excuses for your sin. Make sure that you evaluate whether something is edifying and whether it will build you up, whether it will build you up, whether it's expedient, whether it's helpful. Ultimately, you need to be thinking about that you were bought with a price, therefore you should be glorifying God in your body. So whether you eat or drink, you glorify God. Because the ultimate responsibility within your life is to both to glorify Him and to be a gospel witness for others. And the way that you be a gospel witness for others is you emulate Jesus Christ. And you certainly don't want to be brought into bondage by anything. That's what Paul does. He just walks them through the process. So the Corinthians, for them, question is asked. Their response is really simple. "Hey, I have reasons and I have rights." Paul's response to it, simply this. Oops. Go back. And Paul says, when you weigh your reason rights in the balances of scriptural principles, your reasons and your rights look very, very small. Walk through the filters from a biblical perspective. Now again, I'm going to stop just for a moment here. I'll make one quick application. Even as I go through this, some of you go, Brian, that's way too many questions. You know, that's like 10 questions. Are you saying I'm supposed to be like asking 10 questions before I make every decision in life? All right. Without moving your hands. Okay, don't move your hands. Just do this in your mind. How many actions does it take for you to tie your shoes? Okay, you get up in the morning. Your shoes are untied. Some of you leave them like permanently tied. But imagine that your shoes are untied. And so they're sitting there at the foot of your bed and your shoes are untied. You put your foot in your shoe. I just want you to mentally start thinking, how many actions does it take to tie your shoes? Think through it. Okay, now ask, how many of you can tie your shoes in three moves? Four. Five. Six. Seven. Eight. Nine. Ten. 10 or 11 or more. How many of you have like Velcro shoes? Okay. All right. Just rule of thumb here. All right. Velcro shoes are only appropriate if you're age 55 or older. Okay. All right. None of you should be wearing like Velcro shoes. All right. You stop and you think about it. All right. You open them up. You go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And some of you might have 6 or something like that. But you know what? Until I just ask you, you haven't thought about that since you were 5 years old. You just naturally tie your shoes. Just a natural part of life. Let me just say this. At this point in your spiritual maturation, you shouldn't have to think about these 10 questions. They should come as naturally to you as tying your shoes. It's just part of your life now. It's part of the Spirit working within you. It's part of the Word of God indwelling you. Now, you might not think about them in a particular order. And some of them might just come implicitly to you now. But at this point in your spiritual life, before you're making decisions, you're just stopping and you're going, okay, is this going to be spiritually edifying in what way? How is this going to build up? How is this going to impact my evangelistic life? In what way am I going to glorify God in this? I want to be careful because I know my own flesh and I don't want to be enslaved by anything. I could do this, but should I do this? Is it really going to slow me down in my pursuit of Jesus Christ? These things should just come natural as we grow in Christ. Just like tying our shoes come natural to us as far as our natural lives are concerned. All this is pressing toward one primary principle, and the primary principle is simply this. Believers seeking to glorify God should never associate themselves with elements that are linked to the world system, regardless of their reasons, their rights, and their perceived cost. I don't link myself. I don't associate myself. I don't take something that is morally neutral. If it's associated with the world, I don't grab it and associate myself with it. I stay clear of it because I have a higher calling. Doesn't matter how good it is, how desirous I am of it, how many other people are doing it. The cost is not the issue. The rights are not the issue. The issue is that I live for something distinctly different. And therefore, there's a line to be drawn in areas of Christian liberty. Now, there's a really key phrase in there that I have not defined. And what is that key phrase? I have not clearly defined world system. Have you noticed? I've used the phrase world probably half a dozen times, but I've not defined it yet. That in itself is a whole series. But I want to make a couple points about it. Some elements of the world system we know. There's other elements of it we might not be as familiar with. But the principle I want to just pull out for a moment is the world static or does it change? Does it move? Okay. Let me quote for you a message that was preached. And I'm going to preach the message in essence as it was preached. And then afterwards, I'm going to tell you whether it was good biblical preaching or not. You tell me whether it was good biblical preaching. The preacher did something like this. I see some of you women out there. Some of you women out there, right there and right there. Some of you women out there, you're wearing red. And you know red is of the devil. You get that red off and you set aside the works of the flesh and you start living for God. And some of you girls out there, I see you chewing gum. You spit that gum out and you live for Jesus Christ. All right, now my question is simply this. Is that good biblical preaching? See, most of you go, no. You know, if your pastor did that tomorrow, you'd be like, whoa, where's that coming from? And let me give you context real quick. That's Billy Sunday, 1920s New York City. A woman who wore red in 1920s associated herself with prostitution. And if she was chewing gum, it meant she was available. Now let me ask the question again. In that context, is that good biblical preaching? What he was doing is he was just taking biblical principles and he was applying them to his world. Now, that world's changed. Where we get in trouble sometimes is we take the applications of a previous generation and we have canonized them to be authority. So if I would have stood up today and said wearing red is sinful, most of you would have looked at me and gone, what? So it's not the application that is authoritative. But what is authoritative is the principle. And what we need to do, and what Paul's doing to the Corinthians, is he's saying, here are the principles. You apply them. So what is the world today? In 1920s, it was wearing red. What are the elements within your culture, within your generation, that you need to stop and you need to apply the principles to? Again, regardless of cost, regardless of reasons, but you still need to make the applications. And this, quite honestly, is where some of you go crossways with your parents. Because, you know, parents sometimes, they'll take their application of 20 years ago and they'll say, you need to be doing this. And you'll be like, where is that coming from? Again, I love the school that I went to. I was saved there. I was discipled there. Those people poured themselves into my life. But when I was in school there, men were not allowed to put any kind of gel in their hair because it was sinful. Gel's morally neutral. Nothing wrong with gel. But in that context, it may have communicated an inappropriate association. So they make the rule. I understand that. But we're not there anymore. Right. Now the question is, where are you? Because it's not your parents' responsibility. It's not your pastor's responsibility. It is your responsibility to determine where those lines need to be drawn for your generation. And to do that, I'll come back to what Paul says. I speak unto wise men. Judge ye what I say. Don't make excuses and say, oh, yeah, the world does it, but I can do it too. Run it through the principles. Okay, ultimately, what does this boil down to? I think ultimately it boils down to something like this. Every decision you make, whether large or small, demands a singular starting point. And I have three statements here. But those three statements are not three different starting points. Those three statements are one starting point. You begin by self dies. Self dies. Number two, Christ reigns. When you become a believer, Christ has lordship over your life, and that's everything. It's everything. And then statement number three is God is glorified. When self dies and Christ reigns, God is glorified. That's your task. Is it easy? I'm not going to deal with this politically at all, so please don't take this illustration and think politically. There's a relatively well-known individual by the name of Donald Trump. Donald Trump is well-known for actually his realty before he was ever well-known for anything else. And many of you are familiar with the buildings that he has. It's really interesting. Every single Trump building has his name on it. The reason it has his name on it was when he was in college, he was actually walking through New York City with his father, and he pointed to a particular building, and he said, "Dad, whose building is that?" And his dad said, "I don't know." And Trump thought that was such a crime that such a beautiful building wouldn't have a stamp of ownership on it, that what Trump did is from that point on, every building he made, he put his name on it. So you see, Trump casinos, Trump towers, and if you've ever gone to one of the Trump buildings, his name is prominent on all four sides. Because he wants everyone to know that it is his. Now let's imagine for a moment that Donald Trump has multi-millions of dollars, obviously billions of dollars perhaps, and he wants to put up another monument to himself. And he has two options. He can put it up in London. There is no Trump Towers right now in London. Or he can put it up in, let's say, Syria. Land's pretty cheap in Syria right now. If he came to you and asked for a recommendation between London and Syria, what would you recommend? Now, most of you go, London. It's a no-brainer. Well, he's cheap, and so he goes to Syria. And as he goes to Syria, he puts up this Trump Towers, and he builds this huge monument to himself. And at the grand opening, they pull down the blankets that are covering his name. And on one side it says Trump Towers, and the other side Trump Towers, and the third side Trump Towers, and on the fourth side Trump Towers. And there is this monument to himself, Trump Towers. Now here's my question. What do you think everyone in Syria is going to do every morning? They're going to look out their window and they're going to wonder, did Trump Towers make it through the night? All right, how many windows got broken? How much graffiti got spray painted on it? And ultimately, when is someone going to bring that thing down? So let's imagine that all the windows get broken out, there's graffiti sprayed all over it, and ultimately someone brings it down. Here's my question. What's at stake if Trump Towers comes crashing to the ground? What's at stake? Trump's name is at stake. It's not about the glass. It's not about the metal. It's not about the mechanics of the building. What's at stake is whose name is printed on that building. That's what's at stake. So Trump's reputation rides upon his capacity to protect that building, and so that building adequately reflects who he is. And for every broken window, for every piece of graffiti, and for every explosion that takes place that damages that building, it is Trump's reputation that's at stake. All right, here's the reality. When you accepted Christ as your Savior, whether you were 3, whether you were 13, or whether you were 23, at that point in time, you were bought with a price. And God picked you up. And he put his name on you. And he didn't do what you would have done. He didn't put you in a peaceful place. He put you in a war zone. And he put you in a war zone specifically so that you could do one thing. So that you could reflect his glory. And he's guaranteed you the success of doing it, by the way. But if you allow your spiritual windows to get knocked out, if you allow the world to put graffiti on you, if you allow your decisions in debatable areas to damage you, what's at stake? What's at stake is the glory of God. See, sometimes when we look at debatable issues, we go, it's my call. No, it isn't. Your salvation is not about you. Never was and it never will be. Your salvation is about God pulling you up out of the miry clay and setting you in a place so that you can reflect his glory. So wherever he's placed you, that's your task. And when you fail to do that, his reputation in that place that gets damaged. We can go back through our list that we started with on the issues of debatable things. All I want you to do is, whatever they are, I want you to run them through the biblical filter. The goal here is not just right action, it's right thinking. And as you allow the Spirit to prompt right thinking within you, right action will follow. And when right action follows, God is glorified. And when God is glorified, He is satisfied. And if I can phrase it this way, the fringe benefit of that, you are satisfied. Because you're doing exactly what God's created you to do. God has rightful ownership of every decision that you make. Just release that to Him, regardless of what it is. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your goodness. Thank you for this passage of Scripture that really helps us to think through 21st century issues. I want to thank you that it's not just about meat in Corinth or cucumbers in the Old Testament. Father, it's about the life choices that we make today. And we will simply ask that by your grace you would allow us and empower us to reflect your glory in a way that would be appropriate. And we'll give you thanks in your name. Amen.